Welcome back to the Smoke and Steak podcast, the only English language podcast that is all about Brazilian football. We are back. It is the new year, 2024. Cannot wait to see what this year has in store. And we've got a great episode for you today. I'm Peter, and as always, we're joined by Enric. We are the co-hosts of this podcast, but we've got a very special guest. We are joined by my man, Marcelo Ferrancini. Marcelo is a presenter, producer, commentator in Brazil, and you probably know him from the Brasileirão play, and you definitely know his iconic catchphrase, my man. Please welcome Marcelo Ferrancini. Marcelo, how are you?
Hi, Peter. Hi, Enric. Thank you guys for the invitation. It's been a while since I've watched the Smoking Snake. So it's been a catch up for Brazilian football all around the world. And you guys are doing quite a job over here. So thank you guys for being with us during the broadcasts for Brasileirão Play. Thank you guys for helping us democratize Brazilian football all around the world. You guys are a huge part of that. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be here to talk about Brazilian football and football in general. And thank you guys for the invitation.
Enric, what's going on, man? A good Christmas, good New Year. How are you?
Good. I'm good, man. Everything has been fine. Celebrating with my family during Christmas and New Year. And it's been quite some time. I know Brasileirão finished around December 5th or 6th. So exactly, or around a month from now. So we don't have much to talk about at the moment. So thankfully, we have guys like Marcelo joining us and giving us the chance to talk about Brasileirão and how the season went and everything about Brazilian football.
Yeah, let's jump into it. So Marcelo, tell us, where'd you grow up and where'd you find your love and passion for the game?
Well, I'm a native from Rio de Janeiro. I came to São Paulo in 2021 to work with broadcast and casting matches. But I was born in central Rio de Janeiro, in the capital, in the center of Rio de Janeiro, in a neighborhood called Tijuca, a well-known place in Rio de Janeiro, traditional neighborhood. And I was born in 1988. Botafogo was in a dry spell for 20 years when I was born. My father is a Botafogo fan. My grandmother was a Botafogo fan. And in 1989, the first Carioca I've watched, the first Carioca state championship I've watched, Botafogo beat Flamengo in the finals 1-0 to break the dry spell of 21 years. So my father took me as the lucky charm for Botafogo. And then Botafogo went on to win 90s Carioca. 92, we were Brasileirão finalists. 93, the Conmebol Cup. 95, we were Brasileirão champions. So it kind of grew around me. I've grown in a Botafogo household, despite the fact that my sister became a Vasco da Gama fan. And it's been a part of my living culture around my household, being a fan of Botafogo. And I grew up going to the neighborhood of Botafogo, which is a neighborhood in Rio de Janeiro, close to Tijuca. I went to the center of Botafogo, where Botafogo is hosted on. I watched the matches. I went to the stadiums. I was in the finals in 1992 against Flamengo. My father took me. I was 4 years old. It was the first time I went to Maracanã, and I grew 10 minutes away from Maracanã. So every Wednesday or Sunday, I was in Maracanã. It was part of my family culture to go to the stadium. So I ended up being a fan of Botafogo. Then I started playing in the youth academy of Botafogo. Had an injury, had to leave, spent there like 2 years. And it was always a part of me, being a fan of Botafogo, being a fan of football. I've always watched foreign football, European football. I took my time to learn about the MLS for a long time because I'm a huge fan of the NFL, of the NBA as well. So I thought the MLS could become one of the big leagues from the US. So I've always loved sports in general. I've played basketball, I've played football, I've practiced jiu-jitsu, judo, volleyball, handball. I've always been a sports fan. And the funniest thing is, I recall my youth. I used to play International Superstar Soccer for the SNES with the anthems of the clubs playing on the background and broadcasting, like casting the games for just to myself, me and the screen. And I never thought I would be a commentator after that. I went to study engineering. Then I went to study political sciences. And after all that, I became a journalist with no hopes to become a commentator. And it was up in 2013. I was 25 years old. I had the opportunity to become a commentator for the NFL. I worked for Esporte Interativo. It became a huge TV over here. It was purchased by TNT. So it's now TNT Sports, and I began my work over there with the NFL and the WWE. Then after that, the TNA, I broadcasted an unsurmountable amount of sports, of different sports, and esports as well. And it took me long to become a football broadcaster. It took me like 30 years, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice that you talk about those experiences starting from a Botafogo point of view and becoming a journalism. And you talked about the way how you got into this. But how did you find your way into Brasileirão play, speaking in English, like a language that you're not really used to, being a Brazilian? And when did this start and how did this start at all?
Well, I became an English teacher at 17 years old here in Brazil. I graduated in an English course and then got the graduation all done and became an English teacher, mostly because my mother is an English teacher and she saw value in learning English since I was young. So I did it all I could do, trained to be a teacher, but I don't like teaching. It's not in me. And then I started broadcasting in 2012 to 2013. And most of a bigger part of my broadcasting went to the side of the esports. I casted CSGO matches, I casted Valorant matches, FIFA, Fortnite. And then I had the opportunity. I met my girlfriend. She lived here in São Paulo. We started dating in 1929, in September 1929, and then in March we had the pandemic. So I lost my job. I was working with the company that hosts Ubisoft channel in Brazil, and I had to leave mostly due to the pandemic, and started engaging more with my broadcasting career and giving it more time and. Let's see what we can take out of this during the pandemic. And I went full on to esports. And I had the opportunity. I was called by a man named Diogo Bia. I own him a lot. This man is amazing. And he asked me to test as a Free Fire color commentator in English. Let's go. Let's do it. I went for a test. It didn't go all that well. We had other people also joining, so it didn't go well. 6 months later, he asked me to do it again. I did it. He said, okay, let's do it. Come to São Paulo. It was around 5,000 reais for me to come to São Paulo to rent an apartment. And here, it's an expensive place to rent an apartment. So I talked to my girlfriend and I said, babe, I can't pay the rent and live in São Paulo for that amount. You can live there for like 2 months as you gather some money, try to get somewhere, and then you use the house for 2 months. I said, okay. Came to São Paulo, start living as I said in my girlfriend's aunt's house, and started broadcasting Free Fire in English. And guys, if you think that broadcasting football in a foreign language is tough, Free Fire is something out of this world. It's 48 people killing themselves for 15 minutes straight. And it's unbelievable. You have to pay attention to the map and you have to pay attention to what your co-commentator is talking. And you got to translate what you're going to say. It prepared me to broadcast anything in English. It was out of this world. It was tough. It was hard. But it made me better at my job. And then one of the guys that directed the Free Fire broadcast was a friend of the talents director for the Brasileirão Play. This guy asked him if he had anyone to present to him as another color commentator for Brasileirão Play. The guy that was in my place when I was called for the first time for Free Fire was John Cotterill, another one of the great Brasileirão Play commentators. And when John left, he opened the spot. I went there. Then John went to Brasileirão Play and asked for one more guy. I went to Brasileirão Play. And then I started as a freelancer. A payment match by match. So it was kind of tough. It helped me a lot to stay here in São Paulo and to rent the apartment. And then I went to Brasileirão Play, spent 2021 as a freelancer. Then in 2022, I became a regular guy on the broadcasts. And I believe that it's the future of the business, internationalizing your products. And I think that Brasileirão Play did it really well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, coming from a fan from the United States, I feel like it's made us more united throughout the world, because now we have a chance compared to before. For example, I used to watch matches of Premier and Sport TV, and I never had an idea that this even existed in English. So as soon as I saw that these matches were streamed in English, I felt like this is a nice opportunity, because you can get to understand what the commentators are saying, learn about players. And as you currently work for Brasileirão Play, you guys come up with interesting facts, and some of them I even had to write on my notes to prepare so that when this opportunity comes, I'll ask them to you. The first question will be, what's it like going to school with Renato Augusto and Matheus Peixoto? I'm sure you talked about them almost every week, so now we get a chance to ask you here.
It was Renato was one of my closest friends in the beginning of my life. He left school when I had 12 to 13 years of age. And he was in my class. He was my classmate, and we played together. He was the one who took me to play for the youth systems of Botafogo, and it was really cool. He was a nice guy. He's always been a nice guy. And the last time I met him was I was 18 years old. We were in the Sweet 16 parties happen at 15 in Brazil. Mm. It's the as we say, the debutante party. It's like when the girl is debuting to the society. And there was a girl, a 15-year-old girl at school that we knew from back then. He was invited, I was invited. And it was in the same day that Botafogo lost to Flamengo in the Carioca State Championship Finals. And he scored a tying goal. And we met at the party, and I said, did you need to do it today? He scored a screamer from a mile away. It was from the intermediate zone of the midfield. And I asked, why did you do it today? And he said, bro, I'm sorry. I'm just sorry. It was the last time we met. But he was a master of the craft since he was a kid. He was outstanding as a kid. And no wonder why he is doing this up until right now, and now for Fluminense.
Yeah, I was just going to ask. I mean, it's really topical that you brought him up, Henrik. A huge day for him. He goes to Fluminense. There's that picture of him making the rounds on social media of just a kid in the Flu kit. Was he, but you know, then he ended up at the Flamengo Academy. So Was he always a Fluminense supporter, or, you know, how did that shake out?
I don't know if I'll get in trouble saying this, but he was a Botafogo fan.
Okay. Botafogo fan, I love it.
I'll not confirm nor deny, but legend says he was a Botafogo fan.
Well, good to know.
But he was always a good kid. He was everyone who saw Renato play said that he was going to be something big, and it was clear as day that he was different from everyone else. I had my good time playing, but I was not in the same level. I was a tall kid that played right back, and I had a stretch in height that became my injury after that. I grew like 25 centimeters in 1 year and had to take hormones to stop growing, and I had to stop playing. So it was awkward to see. I'm 184 centimeters, like 6'2", 6'1". I'm not a right back. I should not be a right back with my height. So I didn't have the talent, but Renato was clear as day that he was outstanding.
Well, talking about right backs, I got the next question coming up, which is...
I know what you're going to ask.
Around a month ago, in a Cruzeiro Atletico Paranaense game, you said that if somebody asks me one day, you would love to talk about why the fullbacks don't cross anymore. So go get through that question and explain to us what you got to say.
I believe it's something that I believe that the pictograph of how football is right now was perfect for fullbacks to be good crossers. I've watched Jorginho play. I've watched Cafu play. I've watched Dani Alves play. And nowadays, the best fullbacks we have are defensive fullbacks. Football drew the fullbacks to become third and fourth defenders for the team on the left side and on the right side. And I don't like it because we now have the inverted extremes, the inverted wingers playing for the squads, like left-footed wingers playing on the right side, right-footed players playing on the left side. They have the skills to juke inside and try to shot. So it creates the corridor for the fullbacks to go over, to overlap and create space for the crossings. But the fact that we went from the 4-4-2 formation to the 4-3-3 formation made it so that the midfield is less protected than it was before in thesis. Because it's not. We've always had the third and fourth midfielder were closer to strikers than the wingers are right now. They were stepping inside of the box. They were going for the score. And now you mostly see teams play with two defensive midfielders and one offensive midfielder, which keeps the same security you had when you played 4-4-2. And now you have two speedsters on the wings to help cover the sides. So why not help the fullbacks overlap and cross and go to the assist? Because the defensive mindset of nowadays football comes a lot from the physicality that changed in football. We have a more physical football than we had 5 to 10 years ago. But I don't like football being played only physically. Try to think about, as we say here in Brazil, the camisa 10, the mastermind of the midfield. We don't have that anymore. We had the resurgence of the number 9, of the striker, mostly due to the fact that we have wingers, but we killed the midfielder. The place, the field is wide open. You use the wingers. The wingers are not crossing specialists. You brought back the big man on the middle, the number 9, and you have no one to make that man shine. It was something, talking about Botafogo, that Botafogo suffered through the season. Botafogo had amazing aerial threats. Chiquinho Soares, Diego Costa, Vitor Cuesta, Danilo Barbosa, great aerial threats. But Marçal is not a crossing fullback. He's a defensive fullback. I'll not talk about Di Plácido because he's not a fullback. He's not even a football player. But we didn't have someone to feed those guys the aerial balls. And this is something that is going on. And it starts in Copinha. It starts in the youth systems. When we do not develop the best skills of the players anymore, we develop players to be systematic players. They are system players that fit to what your team is going to play or what is in the trend in football. We are not developing the skills anymore. We are developing the systems.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like there's almost that struggle in the world of football between the more system, related brains. Like you'd think probably Pep Guardiola is the mastermind of that. Contrasted against Fernando Diniz's sort of, relationism. And it's a fascinating time to see that play out.
And Fernando Diniz and Fluminense is the best example of that. He broke that system mindset that currently we have in Brazilian football. And they have two of the best fullbacks in Brazil. Samuel Xavier had an amazing season, assisted to a ton of goals. And then on the left side, you have Marcelo, one of the greatest of all time. So when you see, when you look at the numbers and the results, having the crossing fullback, having the guys that go to the offense and try to help the offense, it pays off. Fluminense won Libertadores on that. Fluminense won Libertadores on gathering their players, stopping the system mindset, giving freedom to the players to play the best they could, to approach each other, to play for ball possession. And it was beautiful. I've broadcasted a ton of Fluminense matches this season. It was beautiful to watch. It was a good football to watch. And I'm not one of those guys that relays on the past and thinks that football was better in the past. And no, I'm not one of those guys. I really like the physicality and how football is more quick-paced, is more strong in the disputes. I really like that. But you don't have to suppress skill. And football is suppressing skill right now. And the teams that don't do it, they're getting the payoff.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's do two more of these quick kind of context questions here before we dive into Botafogo. Thoughts on short corners? I know I've heard you bring this one up. What do you think of them?
They should be banned. I say it every single broadcast, and I will say it again. It should be banned. Short corner kicks are one of the most stupid plays in football. You bring your tall guys, your defenders, to inside of the box. You ruin your defensive system. You open yourself to a counterattack, and then you don't feed those guys the opportunity to score. Even more, you risk losing ball possession and being counterattacked. So this is it. Unless you have the best set play of all time, it's stupid. It's broken. It's stupid. You take one of the best opportunities you could have in your offense to just keep ball possession and do nothing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that unless you're wasting time, it's 9 minutes of added time, your team is winning by one goal, and you need to that time to run by as soon as possible. And I feel like that's okay. But if you do what Santos did against Fortaleza, a match where your team needs to survive relegation, I believe in the 93rd minute, we tried a short taken corner kick, and then it proceeded with Wesley Patachi skying the ball outside the stadium for no reason. It's shambolic. And to see teams play that way, I feel like it's a waste of time and a waste of interest for the fans watching football.
I believe that football is evolving time after time after time after time. So this has been all discussed and thought and agreed upon or disagreed upon, but what happened is that we are trying to become a theoretical sport in a completely practical situation. You cannot apply theory to what skill can change. You cannot apply theory and hope that you're going to work it like the book says if Neymar comes up out of nowhere and gets five men behind him and scores. There's no logic in football. So there's no way theory can work perfectly in football. And theoretically, keeping ball possession is one of the best things in football. So the short corner kicks come from that idea of keeping ball possession. But another part of the theory says that crossing closer to the end line is better than crossing from the midfield. So you have the best position to cross. You're above the end line. Your defenders are not looking to the offense. They are looking to the side. When the ball comes, they are looking behind. They are looking to their own goal. If they manage to take this danger away from the box, they will concede another corner kick or rip that ball to the entrance of the box where you have a player waiting. They will not have ball possession to connect on counterattack. It's, of course, theoretical. Sometimes it happens, but most of the time, it will not be a good pass to create a good opportunity on offense on a counterattack. So create danger. We had great players. We had Romário with 5'6", I don't know, scoring on crosses. You had men making their careers out of corner kicks. Peter Crouch was one of them. You can say Peter Crouch. You can say He-Man that played in Brazil, Rafael, I forgot his name. But you had players that made their careers out of good crosses and corner kicks and headers. They were heading specialists. So why did you take it away from their arsenal, from their books? It's not there anymore. No one crosses well anymore.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you look at crosses, it makes me go back and think to Ronald Koeman coaching Barcelona back in 2021-22. At one point, he said that in corner kicks, Luke de Jong is better than Neymar. And at that time, people laughed at him, like, what is this sort of comparison? But then we started seeing Luke de Jong save Barcelona on many occasions. I believe they won like 5 or 6 games due to a header scored by him in the 94th minute, 95th. So they're definitely very important when it comes to football. Now, jumping into the last questions of those funny discussion topics, what has been your favorite My Man moments? And maybe if you can explain what the My Man means, or is it a translation of Brazilian or Portuguese language or anything like that?
I'm a huge fan of Street Fighter, and I watch a streamer called Punk. I'm a huge fan of Punk, and he uses My Man to like talk to his friends, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, come on, My Man. And I grasped that. And I thought that it would, in Portuguese, we tend to say, meu amigo, like my friend. But I thought that My Man would be more intimate in an awkward situation, you know? Like My Man, what did you do? Like, my friend, what is going on? And I tried it. And I believe the first My Man moment I screamed was with Maurício Destre. And I turned out and said, and the player sent the ball to the moon, and I said, you know, My Man, that was just awful. And Maurício started laughing like crazy. And I said, this is good. This is good. I'm going to keep it. It was not something that was I was preparing. It happened. I had the expression in my mind due to Punk. And it came out like, My Man, that was just awful. And you guys needed to see us inside of the booth. We are looking at each other. We are laughing and we are...
My man moments.
Okay.
You were just saying the first one.
It was with Maurice.
Yeah.
And he cracked out a laughter that made me think that it was done. It was it. I'm not a guy to try to create catchphrases or something like that, but I'm a huge fan of professional wrestling. I've broadcasted WWE, TNA, AEW, and I'm a huge fan of professional wrestling, and catchphrases are a thing in pro wrestling. And it made out my no chance at all goal screen. It comes from WWE. It's straight out of Vince McMahon's song. The first verse says no chance at all. So it creates catchphrases out of itself. And I'd much rather have something that comes out of nowhere than to keep thinking of what can I do to make this catchphrase catch. No, it doesn't work like that. It works when it's natural. And my man was completely natural. And I hope it will become a section of the magazines.
Yeah, I love, well, I mean, we love the magazine reports because, you know, it's just such a great wrap up. You guys do such a good job. And yeah, that'd be a great section. Hilarious. And I love that it came about so organically. And it's just one of those things where even if you're watching for the first time, it's something that like stays with you and you're like, who was that? Who was that guy that was saying, my man? Like, it's just, it's really iconic. And I think it's important, you know, building that brand for Brazilian
Play. Of course. And not only for Brazilian Play, but it stuck with me. Yeah. I have people come to my DMs and say, why my man? Why did you say that? That's funny. Keep doing it. And it was something that, as you said, organically became a thing, and I made it my thing after that.
It's awesome. All right, well, let's dive into this past season. So much happened, and it's going to be maybe a little bit painful going back on this.
A lot.
For you, yeah. And, you know, it's just one of those things where so many ups and downs and emotional roller coasters, but I want to start at the beginning. You know, what were your expectations? How did you feel at the start of the season? I mean, you had just come back up, finished in 11th, pretty good spot for a team coming up from the second division. You had the money from John Textor, and it's setting things up for, you know, a pretty decent season. What were your kind of expectations going into the season?
Peter, what I'm going to say might surprise you guys. Mostly to the circumstances that happened with Botafogo in the end of the tournament. But I broadcasted the Taça Rio finals, the second stint of Rio de Janeiro State Championship, that Botafogo beat Audax 5-2. I broadcasted that in the stadium. And my thought by the end of that match was, we're going to fight against relegation. Botafogo had an awful Carioca. We ended up 5th. We in Taça Rio, fighting against clubs of less expression in Rio de Janeiro football. We were not doing good. And in wrapping up the season, now that I have a cool head, I'm chilled, I've watched the season from outside, not only being inside and broadcasting and being a Botafogo fan all the time, but watching it from afar, that was a hell of a season for Botafogo. The fourth place was an outstanding placing for Botafogo. I was talking to Juliano Formoso, one of our guys from the commentating side of things, and he asked me, by the beginning of the season, by the end of Rio de Janeiro State Championship, if someone told you, I have a contract, Botafogo will be fourth place in Brasileirão, fifth place, sixth place, and you guys are going to Libertadores, would you sign it? I said, undoubtedly, yes. that was a dream season for Botafogo, coming out from the Serie B 2 years ago. Then an ups and downs year in 2022, but an expected ups and downs since we were coming back from Serie B. And then this magical first half that we had in Brasileirão that I couldn't explain. I saw no way to explain what was going on with Botafogo in the first half of the season. And I was not a fan of Luis Castro. You can ask any of the guys from our team. I was not a fan of Luis Castro. I saw the effects of the absence of Luis Castro when we started crumbling down. He was... he had a line of work that I don't like, but that was bringing results. So when we lost Luis Castro, and that I kid sometimes, that there is a saying here in Brazil that there are only things that, that there are things that only happen to Botafogo. It's a saying in Brazilian football. Everybody knows it. And Botafogo is 28 years without a national championship. We have the best first half in the history of Brasileirão. And then Cristiano Ronaldo calls our coach to become his coach in Saudi Arabia during the season. There are things that only happen to Botafogo. And this is one of them. We lost the tournament due to Cristiano Ronaldo. He's the only one to blame. He's the only one to blame.
I think if there's a man to blame, it's got to be Erik ten Hag for Manchester United.
Or Piers Morgan.
Yeah. If we go a little further back, maybe Carlo Ancelotti. But the main reason for Botafogo not winning the tournament this season was Cristiano Ronaldo. And it's a joke. I believe that the problem that happened with Botafogo was psychological. And I drew a timeline trying to explain what happened to Botafogo psychologically. We lost Luis Castro. But we were on the top of the world. We were destroying teams around. And then we had Claudio Cassapa, 4 matches, 4 wins. It created that image that whatever we want to do with whomever is coaching us, we can do. And that was not true. That was simply not true. Bruno Lage came in. He tried to personalize a little bit of the team, to customize to himself, to his way of coaching, and it didn't work. And it's okay. Sometimes it doesn't work. But the mistake comes with bringing Lucio Flávio as the head coach. It starts with Lucio Flávio. When Botafogo lost the three consecutive Rio de Janeiro State Championships to Flamengo in 2006, 7, and 8, there was this joke that was created around the Flamengo fans about the chororo, the crying, that happened when Botafogo lost the second one in 2007 to Flamengo. And the players went to the press conference after that, and they were crying, and they were complaining about refereeing, and they were saying it's unfair. Oh my God. And then it became a joke around the Flamengo fans. The face of the chororo, the guy that was giving the speech, the player that was complaining about refereeing and crying, this man was Lucio Flávio. We knew since 2007 that Lucio Flávio was not a man of psychology. He was a good player. He was a good midfielder. Was an amazing set-piece taker, but he didn't have the psychological aspect in place. What you needed to make Botafogo Brazilian champions in 2023 was psychological. You couldn't let your players get over their heads. You couldn't let the players crumble after one or two losses. You just had to set the team in the correct path psychologically. And Lucio Flávio was not the man to do it. He might be a great coach years ahead of right now, but it was not the time. We needed maybe bring Claudio Cassapa back, maybe bring Thiago Nunes sooner than we did, but we needed a coach. And mostly during that time, John Texter became the guy on the spot, he pulled the highlights onto him. At the same time, Leila Pereira was doing the same with Palmeiras. She became the highlight. But the difference was, while Abel Ferreira was grabbing its players, pulling its players around and saying, let she deal with it, we're going to deal with playing football, with getting better, taking the distance away from Botafogo, no one will hear a word about the team. No one will hear a word about coaching, about... No, let Leila have all the spotlight. She is distracting everyone from what we're doing over here. Meanwhile, Lucio Flavio went to the press to complain about refereeing, to complain about the postponing of the match against Fortaleza, to complain about Adrielson's expelling against Palmeiras. And then Chiquinho Suarez started the contra tudo, contra todos, against all, against one, against all movement around the team. And they let the crap go to their head. That was it. We had some problems and some mistakes on refereeing. That happens. It was one of the worst refereeings, one of the best seasons in refereeing for Brazil. This one to 2023 was awful in refereeing. And we had a lot of problems with a lot of teams, including Botafogo. You can say that Isidro Pita's goal in the win in Nilton Santos was a handball. It was. It was. He deflected with his hand and the ball goes inside of the box. Botafogo just got scored on by Rio Claro. I can't speak about Botafogo. But it happened. Then the problem with the lights against Atlético Paranaense, the match that should have fans on the second half when it came back to be played on the next day. By rule, Brasileirão says that if you purchased a ticket to watch a game and this game is postponed, you are allowed to go to the match whenever it's played. But CBF justified saying that as we had Flamengo against Vasco playing the same day, the safety would be compromised if they took some of the policemen to protect Botafogo's match, so it would have to be with the doors closed. A tie, it happens. Atlético Paranaense is a strong team. It's okay. We were eliminated from a Copa do Brasil by Atlético Paranaense. They beat us in Brasileirão in the first half where no one could beat us. They beat us. It's okay. It's a tie against Atlético Paranaense. And then we have the problem with Fortaleza, which the rule says a team cannot play with at least 66 hours of difference between one match and the other. But the first amendment of this same rule says if the 66 hours are broken due to a postponing of a match, the rule doesn't apply. So Botafogo and Fortaleza should have happened on that Thursday, on that Tuesday, 2 days after the match against Atlético Paranaense. Botafogo would face a Fortaleza team that would be the second team from Fortaleza because they were playing the Sudamericana finals on Saturday. So they would use the second team. It would be an easier game for Botafogo. But it was postponed. CBF and all their intentions, whatever, I'll not discuss it. It happened. You were 7-10 points ahead of your competition. It happens. The next match was Palmeiras. Screw playing Fortaleza. Focus on Palmeiras. That was the match of the season. And we started the match of the season with the performance of the season. Botafogo opened up 3-0 against Palmeiras in the first half. In a first half that should have been 5-0. That was one of the most dominant first halves I've seen in a huge amount of time. Okay, we got 3-0. We go back to the locker rooms. We come back, Abel Ferreira, with great changes. He's a genius. He's my favorite coach in Brazil as of right now. He does the correct changes. And Palmeiras scores the first one, that outstanding goal as well from Endrick. What would a coach do? You take off Vitor Sá, you take off Junior Santos, you bring in a defensive midfielder, you bring in a center back. Park the bus. Palmeiras will not play anymore. If you park the bus, Adrielson would not have been expelled. He would not be the last man standing on defense while you are beating Palmeiras 3-1 in Allianz Park. There should never be a situation where you are beating Palmeiras 3-1 at Allianz Park and you have one man on your side of the field. That's when Lucio Flavio started losing it all psychologically. Because Adrielson is expelled. All those problems, oh, CBF doesn't want us to win, and Textor entering the pitch and screaming that it's corruption, and he did what he had to do. I'm a huge fan of John Textor, I gotta say. I'm a huge fan of John Textor. He did what he had to do. He pulled the spotlight onto him once again. But Botafogo's players lost their head. And Lucio Flavio lost their head. Lost its head. Because after that, we went to play Vasco, and it's a derby. Anything can happen at derbies. We played poorly, and we lost. 1-0. Okay. Vasco was recovering. Then we went on to face Grêmio. The third place team, the second place team in Brasileirão by the end of it all. And we opened up 3-1 once again. And Lucio Flavio made the same change he made against Palmeiras. He took out a midfielder and brought in Carlos Alberto, a center forward. Why do you make the decision of winning 3-1 against the second and the third team on the table, respectively? You're winning 3-1, you make the same change, and you get the score turned on you twice by the same way. After that, it was completely clear that Botafogo was out of the competition, of any possibilities. And you know what? If Botafogo did everything they did in Brasileirão the same way, but they didn't get turned down by Palmeiras and Grêmio, Botafogo would be Brazilian champions. Palmeiras ended the tournament with 72 points. If Botafogo beat Palmeiras, Botafogo ended up with 64. If Botafogo beat Palmeiras, Botafogo would be with 67, Palmeiras with 69. If they beat Grêmio, 70 points. Botafogo would be Brazilian champions if just they didn't take two turnaround matches while they were winning 3-1. This sums up what happened. This is what exactly when Botafogo lost their season. But I'm going to say it was a bad season. Go! Botafogo scored. It was a bad season. No, not in the slightest way it was a bad season. It was a great Brasileirão season for Botafogo. What hurt was the way we got there. We spent 31 match weeks knowing that we would be Brasileirão champions. And we lost it before match week 38. This, the way it was, the cruelty that was involved in that is what made the season so disappointing. But in result, it was bad. It was outstanding. We're back to Libertadores. We have a good team. We have an owner that is destroying the debts that Botafogo was involved in. Before John Textor, Botafogo owned 1.4 billion reais in taxes, in work debts, and a lot of stuff, civil debts, and you can't even imagine. 1.4 billion. This season, he got the word to kill 800 million reais. Botafogo will be close to debt-free by the end of the season. In 2020, I was ready to accept the fact that Botafogo was over, that we're going to have to close, Botafogo would be bankrupt. I was ready to accept the fact that I was going bankrupt with my team. And then this man comes out of nowhere. he says, I'm purchasing this and I'm going to make this a great team. And in 2 years, he delivered way more than he promised.
Yeah, there's so much that you mentioned. I mean, going back to the whole season, you mentioned the first semester and then the second one differing so much with each other. And I remember when you guys had that amazing start by beating Sao Paulo and having some other wins, at one point, your first loss comes away from home from a team that is currently relegated to Goiás.
Yeah.
And after that, they started winning again. And it got to a point where even for us from a different fan base started thinking, okay, so Botafogo has wins. They have a couple of losses, but they have no draws. And we were happy as Santos supporters to see if there's going to be an opportunity or a chance for us to get a draw, that it's going to happen against Botafogo. And we did that. And going back to the second semester, it happened exactly the same. Botafogo ties with Santos and Botafogo loses at home against Goiás, the same exact thing. And it's very unfortunate, but you mentioned those losses that Botafogo had, the one against Palmeiras, the one against Grêmio, and the one against Coritiba. Coming as a fan, as a commentator, or even as a neutral of the sport, what do you think was the worst match that Botafogo experienced, like the most devastating one when it comes to the result that they needed to get from those three?
I believe that for different reasons, Palmeiras and Coritiba. I almost broke my hand in the match against Coritiba. I was broadcasting that match with Juliano. And Chiquinho scored on the PK, and I was screaming. Laza came in to celebrate, even though he was about to lose the championship. If Botafogo won against Coritiba, we would still have a chance. He was about to not be champions yet. He went in to celebrate, and Maurício Desti and the guys of the Portuguese broadcast. It was a party, and everyone is finally, Botafogo is going to win after the bad game that we had. Botafogo didn't play well against Curitiba. And I was broadcasting the match, and Curitiba restarts the play. I believe that the match should have been over, but let's not talk about it. But Curitiba starts to play, and Marcelino Moreno receives the ball by the entrance of the box. And I close the mic and I say, send this man to the moon, kick him, foul him, do whatever you want. And then he finds Nathanael with the pass. Nathanael crosses and Edu scores. When the ball went to Edu, I did it like this with my hand. Like, I can't believe it. And I hit the door, the entrance of the door, and I broke my hand over here. I know I broke my hand over here. It still hurts. And it was that moment when you realize that it's over. The Botafogo Curitiba match was the moment when all the hopes were over and you figured out, no, it's really, really, really over. But Botafogo Palmeiras was a plane crash. We were at the top of the world. We were 7 points ahead of Palmeiras, and we were beating them to make it a 10-point difference with a 3-0 first half that should have been a 5-0. It was the first time, I kid you not, it was the first time in the whole season. I'm a really superstitious guy, and it was the first time that I said, we are going to be champions. I was in my girlfriend's house, and she doesn't like football all that much. Botafogo turned the game around at 45 minutes into the second half. Let's go! But I was at her house. She's not a big football fan. And I was watching on my cell phone. I was watching the match on my cell phone. And Botafogo went 1-0. The ball on the bar. A close call by Eduardo. 2-0. 3-0. And I said, what's going on? We are beating Palmeiras 3-0 to make it a 10-point difference tournament. We're going to be champions. It was the first time that it dawned on me that Botafogo would be champions. And we entered the second half, and Botafogo was holding on to the advantage. We got scored on 25, 30 minutes in the second half. It's okay, 3-1. I was on the top of the world. And then Adrielson got expelled. I said, okay, let's park the bus. Let's see it end. And then in 5-6 minutes, it all crumbled. Like, my God, we had one of the most embarrassing defeats against the only team that can take the title away from us while we were beating them 3-0, and a 17-year-old kid destroyed the match. It was something out of those sport Adam Sandler movies, you know, that he turns it around against all odds, like the Water Boy or something like that. That against all odds, they make it, and the other side fans were like heartbroken. It was not heartbreak against Palmeiras. It was desperation. We saw that we were about to make it a run for the teams that were coming after us. We were close to making it settled, and it became a run for the teams that were behind us. Curitiba was heartbreak. Curitiba was that moment when everything that indeed dawned on the Botafogo fans that it was over, mathematically over. So that were the two toughest losses during the season. Santos was a tie, and it was away from home, and it happens. I still can't believe that Plácido was not guarding Soteldo by the right side. It's unbelievable to me that Soteldo took a free kick by the middle of the pitch and went on to cross from inside of our box with no one guarding him. It's still unbelievable. The Fortaleza match was a tough one. Fortaleza is a good team, and they were fighting for a spot in Libertadores. They were still in hopes of fighting for Libertadores. So a tie in Castellón is not that bad. Losing to Vasco is bad, but it's a derby. Anything can happen. Goiás and Cuiabá were tough, but we still had the lead. We still had that power to... We can decide against Palmeiras. We can decide against Grêmio. And the Grêmio loss that should have been a heartbreaking one was not all that heartbreaking, mostly because of Luis Suárez. The game was never one-sided. It was a balanced match, and Botafogo opened up 3-1 with 1 minute into the second half. The first half was a really close one. And then Luisito went on to be the pistoleiro and do what he does better. Palmeiras was way more heartbreaking, and Curitiba was the dawn of what happened.
Yeah, I love that you brought up those that last point about the Grêmio match, because that's kind of where I want to go for that next question. Obviously, you're a Botafogo supporter, passionate. You follow them day to day, but you know, you definitely got your finger on the pulse of the league as a whole, and you know a lot about a lot of clubs. So I wanted to ask you, throughout the season, you know, Botafogo had rivals that were catching up and eventually would pass Botafogo. But of the two or three, you know, Palmeiras, Flamengo, and Grêmio, and even Rebel Bragantino, were you always the most threatened by Palmeiras? You know, they had a rocky road at sometimes. They lost to Santos, they lost to Braga, they lost in Libertadores. You know, these clubs, they maybe Palmeiras didn't look until the end like their normal, we call them kind of like the green machine, or the you know, just that they're just a machine. They that's what they do, and Abel Ferreira is so good at that, like you mentioned, just putting your head down and playing. Were you feeling most threatened by Palmeiras, or did you have another team that you were really fearing?
I had a logical fear and a sentimental fear. The logical fear was Palmeiras. Because they are this machine, because Abel is such a great coach. And it was a matter of time up until when he got the group back on his hands and took them to the fight once again. But I had the irrational fear of losing the championship to Flamengo. Growing up in Rio de Janeiro and being a Carioca and being a Botafogo fan and being against that huge crowd, we got to respect Flamengo fans. They are an enormous amount of loving and passionate fans that can feel Maracanã week in and week out when they want to and when they want the team to be there, and they will be there for the team as well. So you know what it is to be mocked for losing three straight championships to Flamengo in Rio de Janeiro State Championship, for not winning a lot of tournaments in the 2000s, and for being relegated. You know what it is. You know what was expecting you if you held on to the title just to handle them by the end of it. So my irrational fear was to lose it to Flamengo. And when Chichi became Flamengo coach, I got a little tight. I said, we might lose it to them. We might lose it to them. But the whole time, the scarecrow by the end was Palmeiras. The biggest fear was Palmeiras, mostly due to Abel. Palmeiras has a really talented team, but Flamengo's roster is better than Palmeiras, in my view. But Flamengo didn't have a coach by the level of Abel Ferreira, a coach that Chichi can be, but it took too long for Flamengo to reach Chichi and to get him. So it's been Palmeiras throughout the whole time.
Now, switching up from the 2023 season to a little bit earlier, as you mentioned in the episode, Botafogo getting relegated back in 2020. How did you experience this relegation? And I think they've been relegated before, around like 2016 or 17.
We had two relegations before that. We were relegated in 2002 and then 2014.
Okay, so you had experience with that too, but the 2021, I'm sure it would have hurt as it hurts for any fan. So what was that like for you? And you mentioned a couple of things of being scared that the team is going to not exist anymore after that. What were your thoughts going through that year?
2020 was a really weird year, and we got to say we faced the pandemic. And the last time I left home before the pandemic strike was the Copa do Brasil match between Botafogo and Paraná. Right when Calu was hired by Botafogo. It was the first time I left. It was the last time I left home before the pandemic. Then after that, I spent 4 months without stepping out of home. And I went on to get groceries and came back. In general, I've spent 1.5 years without leaving home due to the pandemic, up until when I came here to São Paulo. And it was a really weird year, because it should have been a year where Botafogo would crawl back with the figures of Honda, of Calu, having those big international names and bringing some marketing in for the squad and making some money on ticket sales, on partnerships and stuff like that. But it became a little rocky, and then the pandemic hit. And there was nothing that marketing could have done. There was no money to capitalize on, because we were not going to stadiums. We were not leaving home. And Botafogo bet high on those big names to make some money. And pandemic ended up hitting it all. So although those high bets that Botafogo made did not pay off, and the big debt became even bigger. And that was when I said it was our last bet. Going to Serie B was a natural consequence of awful administrations that we had, and a poor timing on bets, on those big name bets. By that season, we were offered Ricardo Quaresma, we were offered Arjen Robben, Yaya Touré. Those names were all vented as possible Botafogo players. If the pandemic didn't strike, Botafogo could have capitalized on that and made it a star-struck squad, sold tons of tickets, tons of jerseys, and paid off what they needed to pay. It didn't happen. And football is not a fair game. And it should not be. Things happen and you have to deal with it. And the only thing that Botafogo, and the only thing that Botafogo could do was become an, as we say here in Brazil, a SAF, FSA, if I'm not mistaken, there in the US. It was our last hope. It was vented that a bank would be the FSA here for Botafogo, a big bank here in Brazil. But it didn't make it, but the project was done. And the work that was done in Série B was one of the best works that Botafogo had done in, I don't know, maybe 20 years, financially. And I was talking to Otavio Neto and Casimiro, two big names here in Brazil. They are my friends. We work together in Esporte Interativo in TNT. And I was telling them, they are Vasco da Gama supporters and they are diehard Vasco da Gama supporters. And I told them, the best thing for Vasco in 2023 was if Vasco did not go back to Serie A in 2022. If Vasco had the time to work on a really shrunk paycheck and the cap would be way lower than a Serie A squad. And 777 would have money and would have time to work on a team playing for the Serie B, wasting way less money than what they did in Serie A. And this is what happened with Botafogo. The FSA have had the proposition to work with 900 million reais, if I'm not mistaken, or 700 million reais. One of those, I don't remember. So Botafogo had to kill some of those debts to make it to the correct amount where Eagle Corporation could pay and to purchase the team. And they did it. They had a really shrunk roster with no big names. Guys from the academy, like Matheus Nascimento, like Rafael Navarro. We found an amateur player that was shy, that shone for Botafogo in Serie B. And we made a decent team to win Serie B, to go back to Serie A, with the work done by the FSA. So we come back to 2022, and the hopes for the Botafogo fans was we need to keep on Serie A. The payment for teams for image rights in Brazil are much different from Serie A to Serie B. It's a huge difference between Serie A and Serie B regarding finances. So going back to Serie A was important to make money to make it work. But we had the FSA. We had John Textor, and we had that money that was contracted, that was written on in contract for Botafogo. So, okay, let's come back, and then we start from that. It was a new hope. It was new times for the fans. When we saw the hirings, Lucas Piazon, Lucas Fernandes, the names came coming in, Marçal being hired to join in the next season, and then Chiquinho Soares, Eduardo, and we become starstruck. The fact is, Botafogo fans become starstruck because we were not used to anymore to having those starstruck squads. And when we did have, it was a blatant disappointment with Honda and Kalu. And I believe that the 2020 relegation was the most chill one. But the results of that were the most worrisome in the sum of it up. They were desperate. They were the picture of desperation. I just watched the team get relegated and said to my father is a Botafogo fan as well, and we're over. We're going bankrupt. And Botafogo is over. Let's start choosing a new team to cheer for. It's simple as that. In 2002, we were coming from the national championships in 95. We were finalists of the Copa do Brasil in 1999. And then we get relegated out of nowhere in 2002. That hurt. That was the first one, and that hurt a lot. And then in 2014, I believe that one was the one that hurt the most. We were coming out of a squad with Clarence Seedorf, Nicolas Lodeiro, Gabriel Jadson, Rafael Marques, Doria, Jefferson. That was an amazing squad. And we qualified for Libertadores. And then we went to play Libertadores with El Tanque Ferreira and Wallison as our strikers. And that season was one of the most, how can I say it? The team had no emotion. The team was not there to play. And that one hurt the most. I believe that 2014 was the one that hurt the most.
Got it. Yeah. I love what you said, especially about the SAFs and thinking back. I mean, Vasco, you mentioned them, putting the money into the team. And, at the beginning of the season, you might think, they've got Pedro Raul and a couple of other players that were really looking like they were going to pop off this year. It didn't work. 777 again cuts the dead wood, brings in more players with the money, and they just escape relegation. And the other team as well, Bahia, by the skin of their teeth, just get through relegation. And now you look, Everton Ribeiro is linked. All these players are linked and possibly could be arriving. When you look at the stadium there, the Fontenova, and just the amount of people that support that club, they could be a big club in a few years. And you talked a little about almost the good parts of being relegated to Serie B. It forces you to get serious about payroll, things like that, expenses. Santos maybe have much more to worry about because they don't have that SAF money. Although, who knows how desperate things get, it might be a perfect invitation for someone with money to come in.
But Santos has one thing that close to no team has in the world. The Villa. The boys from the Villa, os meninos da Villa. No team in the world has such a prolific academy as Santos. And, of course, Santos anticipated every kind of money that could make it to the squad in 24. We know that. But Santos has their academy that is out of this world. It's unexplainable how Santos still creates player after player after player, season in and season out. It's just outstanding. I've seen like four or five amazing generations from Vila Belmiro. I've watched the Diego and the guy that should not be named in 2000, 2001. I've seen Neymar Ganso in 2009-10. I've watched the 95 generation that was outstanding. Santos and Botafogo could face each other 275 times in that 95 season, and Botafogo would have won only that one. Santos would have won any of the other clashes. They were the better team. Santos had Jameli, had Giovani, Macedo, Axel, Edinho. It was such a team. Such a team. And Botafogo ended up winning. But Santos has the Villa. And even when Santos is in their worst, like it is right now, they made Angelo, they made Marcos Leonardo, they made David Washington. Look, every single year, there are new meninos da Villa. And Santos will make that money back, mostly due to meninos da Villa. And if they have the responsibility of bringing in a good administrator for the squad, of course. But I believe that Santos, that Flamengo and Palmeiras did everything right, what they needed to do, when they needed to do, and became the powerhouses due to a single good administration. Flamengo had Eduardo Bandeira de Melo, that he joined Flamengo. He became the president of Flamengo, if I'm not mistaken, in 2016. If I'm not mistaken, it's 16. And he went on for the press conference and he said, Flamengo will spend 6 years without a championship win. Flamengo will not win trophies in those 6 years. After that, Flamengo will be the biggest team in the world. He said that fans were insane. They wanted to destroy Bandeira de Melo. He went on to have a six-year administration, 2-3-year administrations, because here in Brazil, it's 3 years. Then you can re-elect yourself for more three. He went on to have a 6 year administration. He won Copa do Brasil in a lucky moment. They beat Vasco in the end of the Copa do Brasil and won Copa do Brasil, went on to play Libertadores. And by the end of his administration, it was 2013. And then 2019 was the end of it. By the end of his administration, Flamengo was the biggest team in Brazil. Paulo Nobre did the same in Palmeiras. They had the money from Crefisa, from their sponsors with Leila Pereira and all that. But he cleared the debt. He spent time with no championship wins. And we have a lot of trophies here in Brazil. So trophies are a thing that go on. He didn't win any and made Palmeiras what they are today. The only thing Santos needs is something like that. An SAF can be better, maybe. Because there's money, more than the administration, there is money coming over. But Santos needs a good administration that caps off on the players that they sell. Meninos da Vila are a money-making machine for Santos. And if they capitalize on that with good administrations, the Serie B can be a good thing for Santos. That's the point. The Serie B can be a moment for Santos to start that debt clean and that turnaround that a lot of teams need to go through to once again go back to the top. You see Palmeiras, when Botafogo was relegated in 2002, Palmeiras went on to Serie B with Botafogo. And then both of them came back in 2003. Then after that, in 2013, Palmeiras was the champions of Serie B and Cruzeiro were the champions of Serie A. 10 years later, it was the inverse. Palmeiras champions of the Serie A and Cruzeiro champions of the Serie B. So all they need is to recompose. All Santos needs is to recompose, to regroup. And if Santos doesn't go back to Serie A this season, the fans need to keep supporting. The fans need to understand that it's time to clean the sheets and then to lay on the clean sheets after that. It's all Santos needs to do.
Yeah, and most importantly, it's time to write new history, because I feel like we've been relying so much on the past that we forgot of what we want to achieve in the future. It was more of like what we have achieved in the past. So hopefully with this relegation, it's going to give the team a new motivation to move forward, for players to write their own name in the history of Santos. And hopefully we don't spend more than a year there, because if we do, as you mentioned, it might be a good thing. But as fans, I would hate to see Santos in Serie B for 2 years. But going back to 2020, so Botafogo gets relegated. They jump back up the next year. And it's a happy year for Botafogo, but we can't really say the exact same for the other side of the table in Serie B. To be more exact, I'm talking about Esporte Clube Vitória, runners-up of 1993 Serie A and Copa do Brasil 2010. And despite that huge downfall, they were able to come back up in the second division, perform the way they did. I believe they won Serie B, and now they're going to be able to play in the top flight next year. So what do you think we can expect from this team? And is it a good idea for teams to drop dramatically as they did and then in a couple of years jump back up and perform in the top division?
Let me just explain something to our friends that are watching from around the world that doesn't know how Brazilian football works. We have the teams on the northeastern part of Brazil the states of Bahia, of Pernambuco, of Paraíba, and so goes on. And Vitória is a team from the state of Bahia, of the northeastern region of Brazil, that sometimes is left out of the discussion of the best teams in Brazil, but never left off from the discussion of the best fans in Brazil. They are always there for the team. The Vitória fans, the Bahia fans, the Fortaleza fans, the Ceará fans, the Sport Recife fans, the Náutico fans, Santa Cruz fans, Paysandu fans. Paysandu is from the northern region of Brazil, but still a region that is somewhat left off sometimes. But Vitória is Vitória has one of the most amazing fan bases in Brazil. And that destruction that Vitória went through due to bad administrations as well helped them as well. It helped Fortaleza. For those unaware, Fortaleza that played the finals of Sudamericana this season, 5 years ago, they were in Série C, in the third division of Brazilian football. And they had a good administration. They grouped up, then they cleaned sheets, and they started building and building and building. They had Rogério Ceni as their coach. Great job by Rogério in Fortaleza. Then they hired Vojvoda, amazing coach as well. And Fortaleza now is one of the top 10 teams in Brazil. And I have no doubt that Vitória can go through the same. We have now Fortaleza as one of the major teams in Brazil. We have Bahia with the City Group behind them in ways to become one of the biggest teams in Brazil. And Vitória can go through the same. They can be another amazing giant resurging from the ashes with a good administration, with cleaning sheets, and with making football administration responsible. You need to be responsible with the administration because football is one of the most profitable products in Brazil. And if you have a team with such a massive and passionate fan base as Bahia, as Vitória, as Fortaleza, as all those teams I've listed, you have a machine of making money for itself. So use that machine, make money to make it more money to make it more money. My grandfather, God host him by his side because he was an amazing man, was a tricolor by heart. He was a Fluminense fan, a diehard Fluminense fan. And I cried when I broadcasted the last goal scored by Fred because Fred was the last player that my grandfather said, this guy is a great player and I love to see him playing for Fluminense. And I got to broadcast the last goal scored by Fred in his career for Fluminense. I was with Laza in the cabin and I was sobbing. I was sobbing. But he lived right by the side of the club, the Matrix of Flamengo. And he became a counselor of the board member of Flamengo. And we were going through those corrupt and bad administrations during the 70s and the 80s. And one day he slammed the desk and he said, you're not the biggest team in the world because you guys don't want it. Because you want it for yourself and you don't want it for the club. And he left the board. That was the day when he left the board. And it's such a real take. Such a true take. Because we're talking about the team with the biggest fan base in the world. We were talking about the country that spends the most money in football. Talking about people spending money on football in the world. The teams in Brazil could be on the same level financially to the teams in Europe. Could be on the same level of the teams on the MLS. Maybe not in Saudi Arabia or China because we know where their money comes from. But we could be on the same level of the Spanish teams and the Italian teams and the English teams. Because our fan bases are much, much bigger than the European clubs. Mostly due to the fact that Brazil has lived and breathed football for 100 years, and the dimensions of their country is just gigantic. You can't imagine thinking of a country in Europe with more than 100 million people living there, 150. We have 220 million people in Brazil. It's a huge crowd for the teams, and people there are willing to spend money. We have poor people that earn the minimum wage and struggle to make the ends meet by the end of the month. And when we get to Christmas, that guy saved $20 a month and he will buy a 20, 50, a 30, 100 reais jersey of the team he's a fan of. We spend money on playing football on weekends. We spend money on going to stadiums to watch the match. We spend money on bars. We spend money on traveling. We spend money on tourism. And football is the center of all it. So Brazil has the crowd and the size and the teams to be as big as Europe. We just need to have the administration to have the responsibility that the European teams have.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, we got to clip all that and get it out there because you said so much, and that's part of the joy of, it was almost like this open secret when I, you know, first really dove into Brazilian football. It's incredible. And like you said, you cannot imagine the scale, not forget, you know, the Brasileirão, but, and even the state leagues, you know, a regional competition. I was blown. I had no idea about the Copa Nordeste. You know, speaking of a club like Fortaleza and just the people that turn out for the Lampions League, it's just insane. The Castelão, you mentioned it earlier. You know, this is a team that probably many Europeans, North Americans aren't even aware of. It's not even, you know, Brazil's Big 12 yet.
It's not on the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, it's a mammoth stadium filled up to the brim. It's a boiling cauldron. It's incredible, and that's all reason why we love Brazilian football. And there's so much potential, and I really hope that one day, you know, Brazilian clubs can capitalize on that just a little bit more, and bring the world to see what an amazing you know thing and phenomenon that it is. It's incredible. But listen, Marcelo, we can't thank you enough. We've got to end here on a high note, or at least, you know, a future looking question here. We talked about 2023. It's now 2024. What are your expectations for 2024? We've got Thiago Nunes back. We've got Jefinho back. We've got Jefferson Savarino coming in from MLS for Botafogo. So it's an exciting time, but they may not be the champions or the title contenders, but we'll have to see. I'm curious to hear your thoughts kind of on Botafogo and then the league as a whole.
I just don't want to suffer the way I did this season. That's all I want. If we're losing, just lose it by the beginning. If we were winning, just skip it until the end. I just don't want to suffer anymore. But seriously, I believe that Botafogo is in that rebuild mode. And it's still early to really measure what we can do under John Texter. But I do believe that Libertadores is a good measuring rule for what this team would be able to do. With a coaching staff, with continuity with the work. We didn't lose that many players. We lost, the main players that we lost were Lucas Perry and Adrielson, and those are big losses indeed. But we brought Lucas Alter to replace Adrielson. Great defender. Really like Lucas Alter. We brought John, the former Santos John, to be the new goalkeeper for Botafogo with Lucas Perry. And Botafogo became a good goalkeeping factory throughout the past seasons, ever since we got back with Jefferson. Then we had Sidão, that had his best career year playing for Botafogo. Then we had some big names going over, and then Gatito Fernandes that became an idol for the team. And then we found Lucas Perry that was left out of the São Paulo squad. And then we are going to find a new goalkeeper, and we are going to develop this new goalkeeper once again. And I hope it's John. I do hope it's John. Savarino is a good hiring, a good man coming in. But I believe in the squad that we have. The thing is, I believe in the squad that Botafogo has. I still believe in Eduardo as the mastermind that he was in the first half of the season. He was playing out of this world. He could not have unlearned how to play football. He still knows. He had an injury. Chiquinho had an injury. Chiquinho had the problem with his father that messes with the head of every human being in the world. Of course, he would be messed. And Jefinho coming back. We're losing Luis Henrique. He's going back to Olympique Marseille. He was a player that I wanted to keep in the roster. And we lost Gabriel Pires, that is going back to Benfica. But it's okay. We have the human material to keep working on rebuilding. Botafogo needs, the first thing that Botafogo needs, and I've been saying that for 3-4 years, the first thing we need to do is to clean our debts, to clean sheets. After that, we, the fans, are going to make money for Botafogo. This is the biggest point. Once the debt is zero, once our money that we pay to go to Newton Santos to watch the matches is not being taken by our IRS, we are going to make money for Botafogo. And John Textor is making sure he's cleaning that up, and he's making money for Botafogo. Many people were mad at Textor when Jefinho went to Olympique Lyonnais. I was ecstatic. I was happy. It was the best. It was the biggest transfer in Botafogo history. And he came back a season later. And we're not paying a thing for it. John Textor knows how to handle business. He has made money for Botafogo that was not being made for 20 years. I've seen Botafogo go near bankruptcy a few times. 2020 was really close, but still, the guy is bringing us back. So what I ask from the Botafogo fans is, hold your horses. It's not a six-month work. It's not a one-season work, a two-seasons work. It's for the rest of Botafogo's history. It took Flamengo 6 seasons. The team with the most money made in Brazilian football, season in and season out. It took them 6 seasons to become what they've become. It took Palmeiras 6 seasons with a huge apport of money coming from their sponsors. Why do you think that it should have taken 1.5 seasons for Botafogo to work it out? Hold your horses. If Botafogo does well in Libertadores, let's support a team. If they are not doing it well, let's support a team. If we're doing it well in Brasileirão, let's support a team. What Botafogo needs today is support from the fans. Fans that supported a lot in 2023, we gotta say, the best thing about Botafogo in this season were the fans. We had probably the most beautiful season regarding fans on the stadium for Botafogo I've ever seen in my 35 years old of age. We need to keep that going on. To swallow the pride of not being Brasileirão champions and understanding that the result was way better than everyone could have pictured in February. The disappointment happens in December. But yourself from February would be really happy with the season Botafogo had.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, just awesome words. And I love that line about, you know, it's not about this season, next season. It's about, you know, the for the rest of the history of this club. So I love that. Marcelo, thank you so much once again. This is awesome. Where can people find you online, your stuff, anything you want to plug? Now's the time. But yeah, just tell people where they can find you.
I'm at MH Ferrantini on X or Twitter. I will keep calling it Twitter because I'm a outlaw, so I'll keep calling it Twitter. I'm at Marcelo Ferrantini on Instagram, and I'll be around. Just there's no other Marcelo Ferrantini around, so if you type Marcelo Ferrantini, you guys will find me. And I have a hidden secret. You know, me and Enric are, we have the same name, but in different languages.
Really?
Is because it Enrique? My name is Enrique. It's Marcelo Enrique.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I have the hidden Enrique name as well. So to everyone around, it's, this is the H on the MH Ferrantini. It's Marcelo Enrique Ferrantini.
Okay.
So thank you guys for the invitation. It was a pleasure. And whenever you guys want or need, just at me, just DM me and we'll be here. Thank you guys. Thank you for the whole season, for being there for us. It's sometimes a lonesome work being a caster, a narrator, or a commentator. Sometimes it's both of us over there. We're trying to engage with the audience. And sometimes the audience is just not engaging, and you guys were there for us throughout the whole season. It was a joy having you guys around with us. Thank you for enjoying our work. Because if there is no Enric, if there's no Peter, there is no Marcelo. My job would be senseless if you guys didn't enjoy and watch it. So it's me who should be thanking you guys for the whole season, for the invitation. You guys were awesome. The best Brasileirão Play fans that we could have ever imagined of having. Thank you for the invitation and for the whole season.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for all the shout-outs that you give us on live TV on a weekly basis, you and other commentators. And again, thank you for being here. We get to speak to you. We get to learn new things, interesting facts about Botafogo and other clubs. And this is what we love doing, learning things about Brasileirão. So you're free and allowed to come here anytime you want.
Yeah, you guys saw that I'm a talking machine. If you don't stop me, I'll keep talking. So whenever you guys want.
Well, luckily for you, this is that's a podcast, and we're the same way, you know. So yeah, again, thank you, and let's hope that 2024 is equally as successful, and we keep getting the word out about Brazilian football, Brasileiro Play, and just people getting interested in football as a sport, because it's something great. And I think, you know, the more people we can bring under this umbrella, it's just awesome. So thank you once again. And thank you to everyone listening, especially if you've got this far, we really do appreciate it. Here's to a great 2024. Until next time, we will see you later and have a great night.